Welcome to the Business Trendsetter Podcast, where we talk about trends and how to grow your business. My name is Manny Turan.
And I'm Adam Hartung.
We are Spark Partners. We're here to help you grow by understanding trends and how to use them day-to-day, as well as in doing scenario planning to grow your business. And last time I was reporting from Grenoble, France, and discussed some of the things I saw. And so now that I'm back stateside here, back in Tucson, I wanted to kind of talk about some of the things that I noticed that was interesting from being in both France as well as, Tucson here in the U.S. And I would say one of the big things I saw was just a lot of, the restaurants, the food in France is just amazing, right? And a lot of the places I went to, there was a lot of farm to table, and they were very proud to say that everything was local. Everything was from local farms and local pasture-raised animals and so forth. So that was interesting. I did see a lot of other things with the in my whole time there, and I was there for about a week, I saw two American cars, two Ford cars. Everything else was Renault, Peugeot, and so forth, a lot of Mercedes. And so it just got me thinking that, in light of globalization, there's still a pretty strong nationalistic component to business. Now, I want to counterpoint that against something else. I went to go visit a electronics manufacturing company that has about 50,000 employees worldwide. And one of the interesting things that I learned is they're ramping up a lot of their manufacturing capability because of what's happening in the shift away from assembly in China. And of course, the whole Taiwan situation is starting to boil over into Europe. And so they're spending almost $1 billion to revamp their manufacturing capability. So I just thought that was interesting how they're getting ready for a lot of this microelectronics manufacturing so that any conflict that might happen in Taiwan will actually be a business boom for them rather than them at that time trying to catch up to the rest of the world. So those are some of my thoughts, Adam. I don't know if you have any questions for me or any thoughts on your own.
Sure. So, of course, when you're in Grenoble, you're not in Paris, which, if we think about the way people live in the United States, we've had a lot of urbanization. People are moving from less dense areas towards more dense areas. So towards the New Yorks, the Chicagos, the Phoenix, and less of the smaller towns and mid-sized towns. It's more people moving to Milwaukee, out of Madison, Wisconsin, for example. So when you were in France, did you get a sense, what was your sense of their urbanization of being in a place like Grenoble or Lyon as compared to Paris? And I know you didn't go to Paris, but what was your sense of that?
Yeah, so one thing I did notice as we were traveling around Grenoble, it's a fairly small town, right? But they are starting to build a lot more sort of high-rise type living situations. There was a lot there to begin with. And we passed three or four construction sites that were building probably 20, 25, 30 story buildings, which is for a small town, that's substantial. And so I did notice a lot of that. And of course their manufacturing base is growing. And it was interesting that there was a pretty strong history, right? Their history is way older than our history. They've got a few thousand years on us as far as a civilization put together in the same way we see it now. So, there's buildings there that were 300 or 400 years old and it wasn't even a big deal. There was castles and, they're closer to 600 years old. So they just have a different mindset. They take their siestas. Every place was closed from 12 to 1:30. We were trying to find some batteries, couldn't find them, things like that nature, or a fuse actually. And so it was like, they're still holding on to some old school trends.
Well, coincidentally, this weekend I was in a retail shop and I was talking to the proprietor I don't know, we got into a conversation about some products they were selling and it turned to France. And the woman said that her daughter and son-in-law had in the last 6 months moved from Paris to Marseille. And Marseille's a pretty nice town and well thought of. And so I asked her, I said, oh, really? I said, what was the comparison? She said, well, they had a one-bedroom apartment in Paris, and now they have a three-bedroom house with a yard and a courtyard and a garage. And apparently the prices have gone up in the last 6 months. But there was this wide discrepancy in terms of the cost of housing between Paris. And she said that her daughter and her son-in-law were taking advantage of work from home. And of course, we talk a lot about that trend. And in the United States, we've seen a lot of work from home with people really pushing hard on employers saying, I don't want to go into an office. I want to be able to work from afar. Now, that was one incident from an American. I saw her American children. What was your sense of people and whether they wanted to go to offices or work from home?
I did have a talk with some of the people we were meeting with, and by and large, they would prefer to work from home.
Yeah.
I did meet with an associate of mine that I've known for a while, and he had basically moved away from the city. He bought a small house in a mountain town about 40 miles or 40 kilometers from Grenoble. And him and his wife were both working from home. She was doing sales of auto parts from her house, and she would occasionally go out and visit some of the customers and vendors. And he was supporting the customer that I was meeting from 40 kilometers away, and he'd come in one or two times a week. But for them, having moved out of the big city, big city was Grenoble, they could actually have a bigger house and more being just a little bit away since they're able to now work remotely.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think this is certainly a European and U.S. phenomenon. I'm struggling to track how much is moving across Asia, and I'm struggling to see how much is moving across India. I think they have some challenges we don't have when it comes to work from home. But it does seem to be very much an ongoing trend. The other one, as you were traveling around and working there in France, did you get any sense of gig workers?
Not really. I didn't really sense that there was a lot there. Oftentimes when I've traveled before to Europe, there's a lot of internet cafes. I didn't see one. I didn't see one internet cafe where they had a bunch of computers set up. So with the proliferation of, handheld devices and Wi-Fi everywhere, I'm sure that those aren't as common. Again, I didn't see even one. And so I'm unsure. I did see a lot of people riding bikes, carrying food, a lot like the DoorDash and the Uber Eats kind of fashion. But they all had regalia and, that was part of another company. So I'm not sure they're gig workers. Who knows? Maybe they could be gig workers in the back end. But from what I saw, there wasn't a lot that I could see.
Well, one of the things that we don't talk a whole lot about on our podcast is government regulations. And the United States is one of the lowest regulated economies in the world. It's always been low regulation, and certainly there's been a decline in regulation since the 1980s. And it makes it possible for anybody in America to say, I'm going to hang out my shingle and do business. You can say you're a sole proprietor. You don't have to get a business license. You might have to go to your little local town and pay $20 for a license, but it's not a big deal. You don't have to incorporate. You don't have to get an LLC to start doing something on your own and start selling products. And that's not true in other parts of the world. And in Europe, there are a lot of regulations. And if you want to have a business, you have to get permission to have a business. You have to get a license. You have to register. Then you have to file paperwork, and it is a lot more of a hassle. Also, there's a lot of things that happen through your employer. Most employees in France eat lunch at work, for example. It's provided for them. Often breakfast is also provided. So they're getting a free lunch, a free breakfast, a free lunch as part of their employment. And so it's a different culture. There's also a guaranteed minimum income in France. So if you don't work, it's not like in the United States where unemployment is, say, $150 a week. It's true, you're not working, you can get 60, 70, 80% of your pay that you had from your employer while you're looking for your next job, right? So they have a guaranteed basic income. And that means that people don't have to go back to work. If you leave your job in the U.S., it's like, hey, buddy, get your feet under you, go find something else to do. If it takes too long to find a job, then you start gigging yourself out. That's not true in a country that has these guaranteed basic incomes where you can take more time to go about trying to find a job. So as we look at trends, one of the things we look at in the United States, and we talk a lot about the trends in the United States, is that the adoption rates of trends in foreign countries are going to be different, even when people really want them, because, again, of regulation. So back again to cars. Did you see a single Tesla while you were there?
I did. As a matter of fact, I guess I should be more clear. I saw two gasoline-powered or diesel-powered vehicles, two Ford vehicles. And then I did see about a dozen Teslas.
Okay.
Give or take. One of them was a taxi, actually.
Okay.
Model S.
Was your sense that the take up or buying of electric cars, what's your sense of electrification in France versus what we talk regularly about, the rapid rate of electrification in the United States?
Well, I'm a car guy, so I was watching carefully for how many electric cars I saw. And with the exception of those dozen Teslas or so, I didn't see, and maybe three BMW, I forget the name of the particular model that was electric. I didn't see much for electric cars. You know, they have a substantially more robust public transit system than we do here. So there's trains and there's buses and there's other things that are just everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, you can take a bus, you can take a train, you can hire a car to take you from one city to the other. So I saw a lot of that, but I didn't see a lot of electric cars as it pertains to the percentage of all the other vehicles. I didn't see any old vehicles either. You know, all the vehicles I saw were 10 years old and newer. Of course, you know, with the exception of maybe one or two custom rides that somebody had, you know, running around town. But, you know, you come to the U.S., you see a lot of old cars, especially in Tucson. You see a lot of cars that probably shouldn't be on the road, but are. But over there, I didn't see hardly any cars that were over 10 years old.
I remember, I think it was about 30 years ago, I was in Houston in a meeting one time, and we got into a conversation and somebody brought up the buses. I think I might have asked the question, do they have a mass transit system in Houston? You know, because it wasn't nearly as obvious as I was used to seeing. And I'll never forget, this guy in the room sat down and said, in Houston, mass transit is defined as that's what you can take so I can drive my car. Meaning very few people wanted to get on a bus. And that is outside of New York, maybe downtown Chicago. You'll go to some really urban places. You'll see people that embrace mass transit, right? But that is by far and away not embraced in the United States to the extent it is in other countries where people, you know, it seemed like everybody takes mass transit. Is, you know, not everybody literally, but conceptually, you see so many people, and it's not shy, looked down upon, like, oh, so you take the train, therefore you're not as good as I am because I can take my car, right? So again, you're going to have a different adoption rate of vehicles. And at the same time, if you're living in a Tucson where mass transit isn't as prolific, it doesn't take you everywhere, it doesn't run 24 hours a day, then you're more likely to say, I need a broke down, beat up car if I'm going to get around at all. Whereas if you were in Grenoble, you would say, I can do so much of my getting around on mass transit, and for the balance, I can use Uber or Lyft, right? And so that these local effects are things that all of us should take into account when we're doing our scenario planning and our strategic planning. And as you said, you saw a lot of Renaults, Peugeots, Citroëns. You saw a lot of those cars when you were in France, and you don't see them outside of France, which goes back again to regulations, right? How many cars are they going to let into the country? How many are produced? The Fords that you saw were probably produced in France. If not in France, they were produced in the UK. So they, you know, there are regulations that inhibit this change. And infrastructure, I want to turn to that now for a minute. If we want to put in 500,000 charging stations in the United States, we all know it can be done. It's not some unrealistically difficult problem to put in all these charging stations. But now start to think about what you just said about all those old buildings you saw in Grenoble. And you start saying, okay, now I have to figure out a way to get electric, more power to the buildings, more power to the charging stations. So I have to put in a charging infrastructure. And it's obviously far more difficult to do that in Grenoble with all of the narrow streets, the old architecture, all the things you want to preserve, than it is in Tucson. Yeah. Tucson's a much newer town. It's much easier to go in and rip up a street, take out a couple of buildings, whatever you have to do, you know, to just say, well, I'm going to go ahead and get these electric charging stations set up and running. So that's going to, again, the electrification, the movement towards electrification is going to be stunted. But at the same time, did you see the price of gasoline while you were there?
I did. It was actually not as high as I remember in the past, but it was at least 1.5, maybe 2 times more than for us.
So what were we dealing with, about 1.5 euros per liter?
It was probably 1.9, 1.86, something like that. It was much higher, yeah, for sure.
Okay. So that's almost $10 a gallon. lunch break from leaders to courts, and then do the euro to the U.S. conversion. And even though the dollar is really, really strong, if the dollar was weaker, obviously, then it would be a more difficult problem. So you have the same time that electrification has obstacles, you also have this issue where there has been a high level of dependence on Russian oil. And so now they're going through in Germany, France, the two most populous countries in Europe. You know, we're going through this exercise of saying, well, where are we going to get oil if we're not going to get it from Russia? And so consequently, they were like, simultaneously, we want to go to electrification, even though we know it's difficult. And so, again, whenever I'm doing this exercise with you, Aunt Manny, because what I hope it does for people is say, okay, when Adam and Manny say, here's a big trend, and here's what's happening and how quickly it's moving, then what you have to say is, okay, and how fast will that happen based upon where I am? You know, what my regulations are, what's going to happen in my town, what's going to happen in my state? You know, things are going to move differently at a different speed on electrification in California than they are in Texas or Oklahoma. Both those states are prolific producers of oil. They have a lot of refineries. They make a lot of gas in their backyard. Electrification is an enemy to them, and they're not going to do anything to encourage electrification. In California, they do everything to encourage electrification. There's a lot more people for the size of the land, and they're trying to contain the atmospheric impacts that come from burning fossil fuels. So, we generalize a lot when we talk about our trends, but when we're doing our scenario planning, it's important to kind of sit down and look around, say, what do I see? What do I see? Now, there's a trap that I observed this weekend that I see a lot of executives fall into, and I'm going to kind of turn this around and let you start asking questions, Manny. So I was watching the Global Public Square on Sunday, which is a CNN show. Fareed Zakaria is the host. And he interviewed the CEO of Chevron. And his point when he started the interview was to say, there are people that look at you as the enemy who say that fossil fuels are bad. We need to get rid of fossil fuels. And, you by promoting fossil fuel use, for gasoline as well as for all forms of energy and making plastics, etc., you're the devil kind of thing. I don't think he said devil, but the point is, you put the CEO on the spot like that. And then here's how the CEO answered the question, which is the trap that people fall into. He said, well, let's take a look today globally at how much energy is made from renewables. And he comes up with something like, it's 6% of energy that is produced by renewables. And then there's nuclear, and then there's, gas, and there's coal, and all these oil, all these different sources. And he says, so we're clearly heavily dependent upon fossil fuel because the wind and the solar just aren't coming on fast enough. And then he really steps in it, because what he says next is people are not going to move quickly because they're tied to what they have. So he says, well, the middle class, they like having their gasoline-powered car. They don't want to pay more for an electric car, so they're going to move slowly. He starts saying how the society at large would be deeply harmed if we slowed the production of fossil fuels because the middle class wouldn't have enough electricity. There would not be enough coal to keep everybody warm. So we would really be hurting the poor, the disenfranchised, and the middle class if we allowed ourselves to go quickly towards renewables, and if we, in fact, tried to pass laws to go too quickly. That going too quickly is bad for everyone, and it's dangerous. Now, he's wrong. And why did he do wrong?
Okay, why is he wrong, Adam?
He tries to make his forecast by looking in the past. And he says, this is how we've operated, and it would require a sea change in behavior if we move to the next thing. And so he's going to say, look, I'm there with what I have. I don't want this sea change to happen. So I'm going to tell you why it shouldn't happen. I'm going to tell you why it's not going to happen. You can imagine if they'd interviewed the head of AT&T, in, say, 1990, after Motorola's launched the cell phone. He would give you a very good treatise about how the telephone, the wires were all run. They were in everybody's house. At that time, by 1990, you didn't have to pay extra. You could have 5, 6, 7 telephones in your house. You could run your own wiring for your telephone in your house. All the monopolistic practices of AT&T had disappeared. And so he would say, you know, these other people are doing terrible quality. It's unaffordable to the middle class. It's unaffordable to low class. You know, it costs you, you got to go buy this phone, or if you don't, you're going to pay $150 a month for service, and which is a huge amount of money to be paying in 1990. And, you know, we can't expect that take up. What he didn't realize was, in fact, it was the middle class and the people that didn't have as much money that drove the consumption. It was the people who said, I really like the flexibility. I like how it helps me get ahead in the world. I like the benefits I get from using mobile phones. And so I'm going to adopt them much more quickly. So you don't want to look backward when you're doing your trend casting. What you have to do is say, really, where are people going? Where do people want to go? I mean, I like to read a bit of history. My father was truly a historian, and he used to beat history into me pretty solidly most of my life. And it's amazing. If you go back and read what people were saying in the 1850s and the 1860s about slavery, and they would say, well, we can't get rid of slavery. It would change America. You know, how would people get clothing? Because we depend upon slavery for low-cost cotton. And we depend upon slavery for our housing and for taking care of a lot of our basic needs. And therefore, if we did away with slavery, it would change America, and it would be horrible. And all of the lower class people who don't have great things today would be really hurt, because now all these slaves would come on the job market and the slaves would be competitive with them and they couldn't get jobs. I mean, it was truly all these economic reasons that people gave why you don't want to get rid of slavery. But of course, in 1865, we did, and you know, we fought against that, and it was abolished, and it did change America. And look how fast it changed. Now, not to say we have equal rights everywhere, but it changed very dramatically. When change happens, you can't look in the rearview mirror, and so you can't sit here and say, "Oh, look, cell phones are going to go slowly because everybody's got a landline phone," and you can't say people are going to go slow towards renewables and electrification of their cars because of the fact that they've already got gas cars and these economic thesis that they drum up.
Right.
I think that what he needs to do is he needs to get out and look around and realize that probably the United States is going to electrify about 5 to 10 times faster than he expects. Now, the developing world's a different story. I mean, if you're somewhere like you know, Zambia or Nigeria, then you've got more difficulties trying to electrify, right? So you're probably going to be slower. If you're in India, which is a huge population, you're going to probably move slower. If you're in Brazil with a huge population and an economy that's not as thriving as, say, China's, then you're going to move a little bit slower.
Yeah.
So again, in our trend casting, we can sit down and say, what is the main trend? And then we can take a look at, well, how fast is it going to affect different locations where I do business?
Yeah, and I think it's also important to realize that consumer behavior is one half of the coin, the other half being innovation.
Yes.
Right? What's going to seed that change are new technologies. And this is, you know, we talk about innovation a lot. We talk about trends. But what are the underlying innovations and technologies that are going to drive that consumer behavior? I mean, just imagine 20 years ago, we didn't even hear about what a Tesla was. What is that? And now they're starting to go everywhere. Not only Teslas, but other, you know, the Ford F-150 and other ones. And just imagine 10, 20 years from now, it's going to be a completely different story. So I think it's going to be driven by innovation. It's going to really drive the consumer behavior. And it's going to, quote unquote, overturn governments in the sense of there's going to be regulations that are going to be forced to be contended with. Just like the internet did, just like AI will, just like other technologies that we don't even know about will.
So there's a website that I read pretty frequently. It's called 24/7 Wall Street. And the editor of that firmly looks in the rearview mirror every time he writes anything. And so he's been pretty down on the future of electrification and how things are quickly going to change. And he hates Ford Motor Company. Literally hates Ford. Once the executives all fired, regularly writes how needs to, you know, how terrible it is. But what he keeps missing is the fact that Ford has already done what you're talking about. They took a look in the future and they said eventually every car is going to be electric, and they set up a separate business unit for that. It's what, you know, we call white space, blank spaces. You get a different business unit to focus on it. That's called Ford Blue. Right. And then they kept the internal combustion engine company is the traditional Ford. And they dramatically, what they've done is they've reduced to nearly nothing the amount of money they're investing in developing new internal combustion engine cars. right? They're not putting money into new transmissions, braking systems, any of that sort of stuff, because they're putting the money into the development of the electric car system. And so what you'll see, as you said, there's no innovate. There's very little to no innovation happening in the traditional business. All the innovation's happening in the new, which is going to get you to lighter cars, better batteries, all kinds of improvements that are going to happen. And that is what happens whenever we start to really think about how these trends become a sea change. For example, China, as much as the guy that runs Chevron wanted to brag about how China uses all these fossil fuels, including coal, is also one of the leading countries in terms of electric cars. They make their own electric cars, and they are shipping almost the volume of Tesla today. They just don't ship them outside of China. And if the rate of growth in their manufacturing of electric cars continues, they'll quickly be much bigger than even Tesla. And we see some other leading countries like Norway that already have over half the cars in the country being sold are electric vehicles. And so the key here, again, is to look at the trend, see what is the main trend, realize you can't fight the main trend. And so we've reached peak oil demand. We're not, you know, and what he's mad about is he wants the government to give him subsidies to go find more oil, because there's been subsidies in oil development forever. And he thinks it's bad that we kill those subsidies. And he's basically threatening people, saying, if you don't give us back the world the way we had it, then you can't expect us to keep making more oil. And we're going to try to grab you by the neck and make your life miserable. And unfortunately, I agree with you. Innovation is going to come around the corner and slap him pretty hard.
That's for sure. And something else to keep in mind is that, you know, the United States is a giant country, both as land as well as population. France has 67 million people in France. And I just looked it up. Norway's got 5.5 million.
Yeah.
So sometimes we hear about these things and we try, and even like New Zealand and other countries, we think of them as the same size as the US. Oh, yeah, well, they're doing that in France, or they're doing that in Norway. Well, what's interesting, of course, is that, you know, the way that we operate is, of course, state by state with the federal umbrella at the top. And so when you look at trends, I think it's really important to realize that in your market, whatever that is, you may not have an entire U.S. market for what you're producing. And that's OK. There's lots of companies out there that do very well selling in one or two states, or, you know, the surrounding states. And so I think that's also important to realize that as you start to grow your own technology, your own innovation, that how you actually reach across the pond and across to another state is really important. And we'll have to do a discussion on some new trends in marketing that I've been seeing, and as well as how to really get the word out.
Well, I'm glad you're back in the United States, Manny, and everything traveled safely. And I understand, though, that you didn't make it back the way you intended.
No, not at all. So we got to the airport in Lyon, and the flight was delayed by about a half an hour. And by the time we got to Frankfurt, we missed our flight to Denver and then subsequently to Tucson. And so we were forced to stay at a hotel. Luckily, the airline put us up for the night and got us dinner and breakfast and all that. And which is a little inconvenient, but nonetheless, you know, when you're doing business, you just got to kind of roll with it. You can't always control the way things happen. And but it was interesting that while I was on the plane from Frankfurt to San Francisco, I had internet. I was able to do some work, and it was about an 11 and a half hour flight. So you can imagine there's a lot of stuff that, I can't really sleep on the plane. So I had to keep as busy as I could, but having some amount of internet was really important for me to do my business.
You in 1 week, you flew through a half a dozen airports. You put your body through multiple time zone changes. You made it back. But when you think about it, think about the convenience of a Zoom call, then you can start to recognize that, hey, if it was 40 years ago, you might be willing to do that every month, but you probably wouldn't want to do that every month now.
Right. Yeah. I mean, matter of fact, when we got to Grenoble, the people that we were meeting, they all had COVID.
Oh, wow.
So the whole purpose of me going was sort of thwarted, but we did meet with some other executives, and it all worked out for the better. And then when we were actually going to have a Zoom meeting here, a Teams meeting in a couple of weeks to tie in the people that were gone. And so, but you know what? There's all this remote stuff that we use. there's still something to the idea of face-to-face. Certainly the gesture was realized. And when we met with the other executives, they were very thankful and were actually very open to discuss things that may not have been able to open up if we was only a Zoom call, only a remote call.
So there's a professor that has a great podcast, and he recently was talking about how everything reverts to the mean. And I don't really agree with him because what he was saying was, okay, you had people say traveling and then the pandemic hit and they all quit traveling. Now the pandemic's back, so it's going to go right back to the way it was before. And I think that he's making it too simple of a discussion. The reality was that when we had a way of doing business where often we couldn't, it wasn't acceptable to try to do business with a Zoom call. You really had to go press the flesh, you really had to go meet people, right? And so we changed. We said, first of all, you don't have to sit in an office all the time. You could be at home. And now suddenly it became, so I could sit at home and I could do these Zoom calls and I could be very, very productive. We go through 2 years of that. Now what's happening is we've said, some of us are saying, hey, we need to get back out and press the flesh. You did that this week. And we do. That's part of business. It is looking at somebody and spending some time with them and having some social chat. You know, that's part of good business. But at the same time, and when I started my career, I flew to Europe every week or every 2 weeks for 6 years. I was back and forth across that ocean all the time. And, you know, now I can't imagine somebody starting their career being willing to do that, because it would be, why would I want to punish my body like that? Why would I want to go through all those difficulties? And that's because the trend is now in place. We are moving to the work from home. We are now using the Zoom calls. And so we get a big pop as soon as the pandemic ends. A lot of us were ready to go places we had planned on going. A lot of us wanted to go visit customers. We wanted to go, you know, meet other people, set up new relationships. And so you got a big pop. But it's reverting. And as it's reverting back, it will not be at the rate it was before, right? And so your experience, you know, like kind of reminds you, well, that is the problem of traveling all the time.
Yeah.
Run into these issues. We've been hearing about, you know, trying to gear the flight system back up again. We've now had several near misses in the last 2 months in the United States where, you know, people are pretty concerned about that. We've had two train wrecks in Ohio as people tried to, you know, move things back way too quickly. We don't have enough pilots to get everybody back to work again, to refly everything at the rate we did before. It will be different. It will be different. So when we're projecting trends again for airline travel, we're projecting trends in terms of supply chain movements and how we utilize transportation. What we have to do is don't try to settle back in and say, oh, okay, we had a pandemic, I got scared, and now then I thought the world was all going to be uphill, we're never going to get on a plane. Well, that would be wrong. But saying that we're going to go back to traveling the way we did in 2020, that would be wrong as well. And so it is, there is some sensitivity that we have to take to how fast this stuff is moving. We've got some pops in some of it. We beat Amazon way harder than it ever expected. And we're not, but now we're going back to stores. So the Amazon growth rate is not what it was in the pandemic. But all of that is plannable. All of that is plannable. And if we're good strategic planners, we sit down and we go through that, and it helps us figure out where to put our resources, where to find the opportunities.
Very true, Adam. And in my broken French, okay, so don't judge me too much here. Plus je change, plus c'est la même chose. Which is, the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Okay. Well, thanks, Manny.
Thank you, Adam. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye-bye.
Cheers.